They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Happy New Year. Welcome again to Necessary and Proper. This is Nate Kaczmarek, and I'm the director of the Article 1 Initiative. 2017 was a great year for the initiative. We launched this podcast, held live events across the country, and hosted our first ever writing contest. In particular, we were pleased to present several interesting panels featuring great guests here in Washington, D.C. Because of this, we thought that we would begin this new year with a three-part series featuring the audio recordings of some of our best live discussions from 2017. For today's episode, we decided to revisit the September presentations of longtime Hill Chief of Staff David Hoppe and Professor Francis Lee from the University of Maryland. The program was held in Rayburn House Office Building and was titled Funding the Government, the Budget Process, and Omnibus Spending Bills, and it provides a thought-provoking review of congressional budgeting and recommendations for reform from both an academic perspective and the real-world experience of a frontline congressional staffer. We hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, we welcome your feedback via email at articlei@fedsoc.org. Hello and good afternoon, everyone. I'm Nate Kaczmarek with the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. Thank you all for coming. The initiative is committed to highlighting the issues facing our modern legislative branch with an aim of exploring the causes of and resulting harms from its dysfunction. We're also focused upon the possible solutions which can restore Congress to the strong, co-equal body our founders intended. For today's luncheon discussion, we've chosen a complex but timely topic, the congressional budget process and omnibus spending bills. Since the 1970s, Congress has frequently foregone traditional budgeting procedure and chosen to utilize omnibus spending bills. Omnibus packages offer members of Congress an expedited voting process, combining several or even all 12 appropriations bills into one decision presented to the whole. This methodology saves the legislative branch a great deal of time, but it's not without its critics. The humorist Will Rogers once quipped, "Congress doesn't vote on the bills, they just wave at them as they go by." So, does the current appropriations process and eventual omnibus legislation improve our Congress, how it functions, or does it weaken it? And does the apparent efficiency come at the expense of proper deliberation and scrutiny? To help us with these and other important questions, we are fortunate to have two very knowledgeable experts with us today, and their abbreviated bios are as follows. Professor Francis Lee is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland, where she teaches courses in American government, the public policy process, legislative politics, political ambition, and political institutions. Her research interests focus on American governing institutions, especially the U.S. Congress. She is co-editor of the Legislative Studies Quarterly, a scholarly journal specializing in, you guessed it, legislatures. Her most recent book was published last year and is titled Insecure Majorities, Congress, and the Perpetual Campaign. Her work has received national recognition, including several prominent political science awards. Our other panelist is David Hoppe, who is president of Hoppe Strategies, a strategic planning, lobbying, and political consulting firm. He has 29 years of experience on the Hill, including directing whip offices in both the House and Senate. He led the Senate Majority Leader's Office during the Clinton and Bush 43 administrations. Among several offices, he has worked with House Speaker Paul Ryan, Senator John Kyle, Senator Trent Lott, Congressman Jack Kemp, and Senator Dan Coats. Thank you both for joining us. Before I turn it over to Professor Lee, please note that following the panelists' remarks, we will have question and answer from our audience. So please do think about what you would like to ask our panelists. With that, I'll turn it over to Professor Lee.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Nate, for that nice introduction. I'm very glad to be here and to be able to contribute to the Federalist Society's Article I initiative. So it's true, Congress has been struggling, increasing difficulties with both appropriations and annual budgets. The problem has been escalating for some time, and it has been getting progressively worse. By way of background, let me share a couple of figures from Princeton political scientist Nolan McCarty. So this figure displays progress on the budget resolution. It's four steps: House passage, Senate passage, initial passage, then final passage in each chamber. And as you can see, from 1976 to 1998, Congress always successfully passed an annual budget resolution. Since 1998, Congress has only completed a budget resolution half of the time, 10 of the 19 years, or 10 of the 19 Congresses. No fiscal year 18 budget has cleared despite unified government this year. Likewise, Congress has also had more difficulty passing appropriations bills. This figure displays how many appropriations bills were on time. So you should look for the distribution to be centered over the zero, and then how many were 2 months late, 4 months late, 8 months late, et cetera, after the start of the fiscal year. The figure on the left shows all the years between 1974 and 2014. And as you can see here, the modal bill, appropriations bill, was 3 months late over the whole time period. In recent years, the whole distribution shifts to the right. Most appropriations bills have been late. Very few have been completed on time since 2002. Now, the Senate is more of the reason for these problems than the House. The House is a majority rule institution, and a majority party that's able to hang together is able to pass these bills. But both chambers have been having more and more trouble, as is evident in this figure from a 2015 Brookings Institution study by Peter Hansen. The top two figures on the slide show the proportion of appropriations bills in the House and Senate on which no floor vote was called. The House, as you can see, clears a markedly higher percentage of its bills than the Senate all through the period. But the trend of not taking floor votes on appropriations bills has been increasing in both chambers. The bottom figure displays the use of omnibus bills. Here you can see the increase in the use of those all through the time period. As of right now, the House has passed two omnibus spending bills for fiscal year 2018, and the Senate has passed none. So the bottom line is that recent Congresses often fail to pass budgets at all. They don't take many votes on individual appropriations bills, and instead they usually wind up using omnibus measures to fund the government, usually after the fiscal year begins. Now, I don't think anyone can defend omnibus legislating on the merits. This is not the way to capitalize on Congress's strengths as a deliberative institution. These centralized processes don't allow input from rank-and-file members in the form of open debate and amendments. These ad hoc, highly centralized processes like this do not take advantage of the expertise of committees who really know the issues. Incentives to be an expert appropriator have declined. The chairmanship of appropriation is a less desirable position than it used to be. They used to be the cardinals of the Congress, the chairman of the appropriation subcommittees, and their status is not what it once was. But I don't think it's possible to just respond to these patterns by exhorting Congress to go back to the regular order, even if the regular order is preferable in theory. The reasons why regular order has deteriorated go deep. Omnibus bills are often all Congress is capable of doing. Intensifying partisan conflict in Congress is the major culprit here. Conflict slows down any legislative body and partisan conflict most of all. Intense, rigid partisan conflict is especially difficult for the Senate to manage, which has a long history of operating on the basis of supermajorities and unanimous consent. Generally speaking, a Senate majority party cannot adopt or even debate legislation without the minority party giving the green light. As the parties have polarized with the near extinction of conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans, it becomes progressively more difficult to legislate. But as we think through the political obstacles that stand in the way of Congress adhering to regular order on appropriations, I'd like to focus attention on an important contributing factor, one that in my view doesn't receive enough attention, namely the intense two-party competition for control of national institutions. Back in the 1960s, 1970s, it used to be conventional wisdom to describe American politics as being made up of a sun party and a moon party. The first time I ran across this metaphor, I had no idea what it even meant. But this metaphor meant that it was normal for American politics to have a dominant party and a secondary party, and for most of the important issues of the day to be worked out among factions within the dominant party rather than between the two parties. But one of the most striking things about American politics today is its ferocious party competitiveness. Since 1980, Republicans and Democrats have each held the presidency about half the time. Likewise, in House and Senate since 1980, Democrats have held the majority for 9 Congresses and Republicans for 10 Congresses. Divided government has been the normal state of affairs. The evenness of today's partisan balance is not normal for U.S. history. This first figure displays a simple measure of two-party competition since the Civil War. All it is the average of the Democratic Party's share of House seats, Senate seats, and the Democratic Party's share of the two-party vote for president. I then take the difference from 50 so that I can show periods with Democratic majorities above the line and periods with Republican majorities below the line. And taller lines mean that a party is more dominant. So as you can see here, the period since 1980 stands out from this long time series, you know, beginning with the end of the Civil War, for its narrow and switching majorities. The more typical pattern over this long period is for one party to enjoy an advantage over the other. The Republicans were dominant in national politics for a decade after the Civil War, and then again between 1896 and 1932. Democrats were similarly dominant for decades after the New Deal. The period most similar to today's competitive environment was the partisan stalemate after the Hayes-Tilden contested election of 1876 until the elections of 1894. Those decades of the late 19th century are probably the most analogous period to the present. And like our era, it was also a period of frequent divided government, intense partisan conflict, and limited congressional productivity. Two other exceptional periods worth noting also circled now on the figure. The Progressive Era split in the Republican Party that generated party competition between 1910 and the so-called return to normalcy, meaning normal Republican majorities, with Harding's landslide election in 1920. Before the present, the last major burst of intense competition for control of Washington institutions lasted around a decade at the middle of the 20th century, from the loss of the Democratic majority at Truman's first midterm until the crushing Republican defeats in the 1958 midterms, after which Democrats held roughly 2-1 majorities in the House and the Senate. The second figure sums up and simplifies the patterns. I'm just displaying the index's divergence from a 50-50 balance for each decade. The closer the bar to zero, the more competitive the decade. The time since 1980 stands out as the longest sustained period of near parity between the parties since the Civil War. In the post-1980, post-1994 era, control of national institutions have been pervasively in play. And when I say in play, what I mean is that both parties, when they're out of power, see themselves as within striking distance of retaking control. You can see this also in news coverage of congressional elections. After 1958 and before 1980, news coverage of congressional elections was focused on individual races or on states or regions of the country. You know, what's happening in the, in a particular region would be the focus of a news story. Reporters did not write about the possibility that the majority control of Congress would switch. But as you see here, there's much more preoccupation with majority control in contemporary news coverage of Congress. Amazingly, there have already been a plethora of news articles analyzing Democrats' 2018 chances. And those articles began to appear the week after the 2016 elections. Presidential elections in the current era have been very close, not just in the popular vote, but in the Electoral College. This figure displays the winning presidential candidate's share of the Electoral College vote. As you can see here, it was once typical for presidential candidates to win all across the country and to amass large majorities in the Electoral College. Between 1932 and 1988, the winning presidential candidate received at least 80% of the Electoral College vote in 10 out of 14 elections. Since 1988, no winner has come anywhere close to getting 80%. There hasn't been a presidential landslide in nearly 30 years. So how does this intense party competition affect congressional incentives in budgeting and appropriations? I'm going to offer three implications. First, intense party competition drives members and parties to focus on messaging efforts. A highly competitive political environment strengthens the incentives of congressional leaders to focus on messaging, meaning positioning themselves before external constituencies and looking for ways to score political points against the opposition. In the Senate, this problem is especially dysfunctional. Anytime the majority party seeks to move legislation, even must-pass bills, the minority demands amendments. The purpose of many of these amendments is purely political, meaning that the amendments are just for messaging purposes. No one expects them to result in change of policy. The amendments are designed wherever possible to embarrass the majority and put it on the wrong side of public opinion. One longtime Senate staffer I interviewed for my last book referred to this process as the spanking machine. You know, all the political messaging votes that the minority party will demand is the price for moving anything forward. I thought this was a particularly telling exchange between Senator McConnell and Senator Reid from 2014. McConnell said, these are actually from 2011. This is not the nuclear option. This is they're talking about potentially moving to the nuclear option. The Democrats are contemplating it. McConnell says, I can remember when I was the whip in the majority saying to my members over and over again when they were whining about casting votes, they did not want to vote, that the price of being in the majority is that you have to take bad votes. Reid says, I agree with the minority leader that the deal around this place is that the majority sets the agenda and the minority gets to offer amendments. That's been the rule since I got here. Now, oftentimes the price the minority party tries to exact from the majority in terms of the number of amendments is unacceptable. They'll ask for too many amendments, and when their requests are granted, they still won't necessarily allow the bill to come to a vote. This dynamic is key to understanding why the Senate majority often won't take appropriations bills to the floor. This kind of politics is also present in the House as well. Appropriations bills are typically handled under open rules, which subjects the party controlling the House to some of the same kind of problems that the Senate majority party endures. In recent years, minority party Democrats have deployed amendments about where the Confederate flag can be displayed. To this kind of purpose. On multiple occasions, the House leadership has been forced to pull appropriations bills from the floor rather than subject their members to votes on these or to pass the bills containing the prohibitions that are objectionable to a large block of their members. By the same token, the budget resolution has become really just a vehicle for messaging rather than a plan for budgeting. The resolution is often not grounded in realistic assumptions, and it will promise more than can be delivered. Interestingly, this focus on messaging is a broader phenomenon that extends beyond budgets and appropriations. One of the most striking institutional changes in Congress since the 1970s is that Congress has created so much more internal capacity for messaging. In both chambers of Congress and among both Republicans and Democrats, members have built this elaborate infrastructure for the creation and dissemination of partisan messages. These figures will display the changes over time. What you see here are the total number of aides working for Senate leadership offices, those are the bars, as well as the share of the total with job titles in communications between 1961 and 2015. The figures on two axes here. There were no Senate leadership staffers working in appropriations before 1977, but the rise began to take off as the Senate majority goes into play in the lead up to the 1980 elections where Republicans took control. The share in communications has steadily escalated, sort of an arms race between the parties over the period. By the end of the series, leadership staff were at close to their highest point, and communicators approached half of all Senate leadership aides. The trends in the House were more gradual, also tied to competition for control. Before the 1990s, the share of leadership staff in communications held around or below 10%. But during the 1990s, the number of leadership staff doubled. Those working in communications nearly tripled. By the end of the series, those working in communications had advanced to a third of all the leadership aides on the House side. In short, the contemporary legislative branch includes a workforce of professional communicators who work full-time on partisan public relations. Messaging politics can get in the way of appropriations and budgeting, as well as compromise on lots of other policy issues where compromise is needed in order to make legislation go forward, especially given how the Senate operates. Second, this intense competition for majority control undercuts incentives to engage in long-term budget planning. In a system where elections happen every 2 years, it's hard to get elected officials to think long-term under any conditions. But the time horizon gets even shorter when the next elections hold out the possibility of a change of party control or a major shift in party power. For decades in the 20th century, the only real question about congressional elections would be how big the Democratic majority would be. That's a very different political environment from one in which the identity of the party that will be in power after 2 years is in doubt. Our current environment of seesawing elections in such a closely divided electorate makes it more difficult to focus on the long term. Finally, party competition weakens incentives to deal with fiscal trade-offs. Budgeting and fiscal restraint and appropriations requires difficult political and policy trade-offs, choices. Any effort to close budget deficits or stick to appropriations caps involves dangerous and potentially unpopular policy choices. To budget responsibly, leaders must manage these trade-offs, prioritize among competing goods, and allocate scarce resources. Meanwhile, those not in power are free to stand aside with clean hands and criticize. They don't have to confront trade-offs or hard decisions about priorities, and they don't feel the same pressure to accept imperfect outcomes. This is a government versus opposition dynamic. It's a pervasive part of party politics all around the world. It's the dominant cleavage in parliamentary politics. Battles in parliaments take place between the parties in government and those in opposition, and not along left-right lines per se. Government governs and the opposition opposes. The U.S.'s complex political system with checks and balances obscures party responsibility and this dimension of party conflict. But even though party responsibility is more diffuse in the U.S. system, it's not entirely lacking in that one party usually has more institutional power and responsibility for outcomes than the other. So we still pit the ins against the outs as in other democracies. Incentives for members of Congress to engage in this style of partisan conflict have increased as party competition for control of the institution has intensified. Let's look at the political situation from the vantage point of both parties. First, an out party is likely to perceive advantages from refusing to engage in serious negotiations to close deficits. Refusing to come to an agreement on difficult issues like debt and deficits offers an out party an opportunity to publicly criticize the deficiencies of the majority's efforts And it may still opt to do so even if the majority works hard to accommodate or meets the minority halfway. A majority that can't get any help from the minority party in governing is likely to struggle to maintain its unity and will look less than competent in the process. On the other hand, if an out party does come to a bipartisan deal on an issue, it will have to bear responsibility for unpopular outcomes. That does not help it win back power. So just thinking in purely political terms, an out party looking to win back power is likely to prefer instead to make the in party pay the full political price for making the hard choices. Meanwhile, a party in power under these highly competitive conditions also has a hard time making difficult choices, perceives its grip on power as tenuous and endangered. Serious efforts to achieve fiscal balance inevitably entail political risk. Achieving fiscal balance means that voters will have to pay higher taxes or accept lower services or some combination of the two. A party in power worried about the loss of its majorities will want to avoid being saddled with responsibility for making unpopular choices. Looking for a path forward, I think reformers need to attend to the difficult political circumstances lawmakers face in this intensely party competitive environment. If we expect members of Congress to make tough decisions in an environment where so many of the political incentives push in the other direction, they probably need some political cover to do so. That, in my view, was one of the remarkable things about the Budget Control Act of 2011. The solution that Congress engineered, one that was successful in imposing some spending constraint, was set up in a way that made it seem that no party was responsible for the unpopular decisions. Congress established a set of tough, across-the-board cuts, budget cuts, that would go into effect as a kind of penalty if the supercommittee failed to reach an agreement. But if the supercommittee, which was made up of an even number of Republicans and Democrats, had reached an agreement, then the process would have produced bipartisan cover. No party would be able to get advantage. So regardless of whether the supercommittee succeeded or failed, the painful consequences were nobody's fault. Because congressional budgets, however, are passed on strictly partisan lines, they're not a good vehicle for getting members to deal with difficult party trade-offs or policy trade-offs, budget, especially fiscal restraint. The budget process is set to put the entire responsibility for budgeting on one party, the majority party, and it gives it no minority party cover. Such a party has incentive to be risk-averse under today's competitive conditions. It will want to do things that make its coalition happy, and it will not want to do things that will impose pain or costs, because those costs are traceable right back to them. They have no place to hide from the political fallout that occurs. A process that protects parties from blame, especially the majority party, is probably needed in order to impose fiscal discipline under current conditions. Okay.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Let me talk a little bit about the history of the Budget Impoundment Control Act and appropriations and what I see as a, if you will, on and off practitioner over the last 40 years in this process. First of all, just to sort of set the definition, who here knows what transition quarter means? I figured that. The Budget Impoundment Control Act was passed in 1974. Now, the reason it was passed is because Richard Nixon was just about to be impeached, and he had virtually no power. And the Congress was aching to control the executive branch, because one of the things the executive branch did under Richard Nixon and under other presidents, to be honest about it, is they would impound money. The Congress would pass an appropriation saying, spend this money, and the administration would say, nope. They didn't change it. They didn't put it someplace else. They didn't spend it. They just didn't spend it. And Congress hated this, and they had no law requiring the administration to do it. So when Nixon was weak enough during the Watergate period, the Congress passed the Budget Impoundment and Control Act. That's what created Congress's institution, the CBO, and gave Congress this a budget process. Now, the budget process, when it was set up, the fiscal year used to end on June 30th. And as they went through this, they realized that they were putting this together, it would delay the work they were going to do in their appropriations bills, so they created what was called a transition quarter. And in calendar year 1976, we had a transition quarter. We had a fiscal year that ended June 30th. We had a transition quarter that then went till the end of September. And then we started the new fiscal year after that. So fiscal year 1977, was the first time we had a fiscal year that went from October 1st of 76 to September 30th of 1977. There, we solved that little problem of transition quarter. I was actually around to participate in watching the transitional quarter take place, and frankly, it didn't mean much. We just gave them, we added some money into the appropriations process and just threw it in there. What we had done for the year, they threw in enough money to take them 3 more months and went ahead with the 1977 or fiscal year 77. But what it was done, what was created in the Budget Act, if you look very carefully, is really an adding machine to do more and more spending. It is set with the current services budget to be something that encourages spending, more spending year after year after year. It was written by a Democratic Congress that had control of the Congress and at that point the unique control over the executive branch because Richard Nixon was so weak he had no power to do much of anything. And so that budget was, and that budget process is one that had a little hook in it that most people didn't see. And it was called reconciliation. And nobody really thought it was all that big a deal. So they set up this process, and the process was really to sort of give the Congress the ability to compete with the administration, with the OMB, by having a CBO, and let Congress say, this is our budget. The president had always set up a budget. That's what Congress worked off of, and they passed the appropriations bill to decide what they would do. This set out a nice, orderly process. That time, he had 13 appropriations subcommittees, 13 appropriations bills. And the budget process said, okay, this is how much we can spend, and this is how much each appropriations committee subcommittee gets, not unlike what we do today, or try to do today. And then all those go together, and we put them into a budget, and we pass it, and then we go on our merry way. And that sort of happened, but nobody used reconciliation until 1981. When a new director of the OMB, a former congressman from Michigan, his name was Dave Stockman, figured this little thing out. And he looked at it and he said, wait a minute, we can try and cut spending here. And at that point, they were cutting maybe tens of millions of dollars, and that was looked at as a big deal. You want to challenge Congress and tell them to not spend this money, and that's the way you did it, was through this reconciliation process. Well, nobody had thought about that, and that's the reason you really didn't have any restrictions, much in the way of restrictions on the Senate side. The Byrd rules, that I'm sure a number of you are familiar with, some like, some don't like, I'm sure, were put into effect in 1986. And they were put into effect in 1986 because as you did more and more reconciliation bills, the House, with a Rules Committee, could figure out how to get around them, work them, do what they needed to do. The Senate, on the other hand, was very beholden to the House, and there were a number of things with the freedom of debate in the Senate. You could move to do different things. And so Senator Byrd, looking at this, really decided that what he didn't want done, first of all, is that the appropriations would not be changed by reconciliation. And he had some other things he wanted to do as well, which protected some of the Senate rights. And frankly, there are some of those things which need to be done. But also, as Senator Byrd was usually very good at doing, because he was a very smart man who knew the rules of the Senate better than most everybody else, is he stuck a couple things in there to make sure he could control the process on the Senate side. And that's the Byrd rules, the Byrd bath, all the Byrd things House people worry about when they send a reconciliation bill over to the Senate. The disadvantages, if you will, that they see in that come from a time when Senator Byrd, who was smart enough to understand what this was doing to the Senate and the Senate's prerogatives, figured out a way to limit how much quote-unquote, damage he thought it could do in the Senate. And so you have that set of rules, which are not only rules of the Senate, they are law. They were put into law and are signed into law. So it's not just as if you're changing budget rules when you deal with the Byrd rules. These are laws of the United States of America signed into law. That brought some balance to this. But what you see progressively over time from 1976 on is a greater and greater use of reconciliation. The next big movement on reconciliation came in 2001 when the House decided they would put tax cuts into a reconciliation bill. And it was a question that was considered by the parliamentarian of the Senate, and there was great discussion, which was held at that time, private discussions, I will say, at which the House members came and talked to the senators about what they, whether it was possible or not to do taxes in a reconciliation bill. And one of the parliamentarians of the Senate argued that it was not and didn't want to do this. And he left his job, and they found a Senate parliamentarian who would say, yeah, it's possible to do this. And what we have now is a situation where you can do three separate types of reconciliation bills off this. You can do a tax reconciliation bill, you can do a spending reconciliation bill, and you can do a debt limit reconciliation bill. Now, if you combine any spending in the tax reconciliation bill, the Senate parliamentarian has said you lose the right to do three because you've done some spending stuff. Now, in taxes, there's always spending because you have things like the EITC and other tax issues, which are tax expenditures. You are actually spending money, and they show and count on CBO's scorecard as spending money. So if you are cutting the spending as well as doing things on taxes, you lose your right to do two separate reconciliation bills, and you get, instead of three possibilities that year, you get two. And the Senate doesn't like doing debt limit on a reconciliation bill ever. It can be done, but you got to. But what you're looking at here is the evolution of a very powerful weapon in Congress. The budget process, which had in it something that the creators of the budget process never really imagined would be worked in the way it was, and that's this reconciliation process, and it gathered strength and power over the years. But what you also see happening here is that this division that Francis talked about between a budget, which is sort of general, here's our policies, here's what we want to do, and let's go get them. And it's a team exercise. The red jerseys and the blue jerseys, who's ever in the majority, they got to produce the votes for a budget because the blue jerseys ain't going to vote for the red jerseys, and the red jerseys ain't going to vote for the blue jerseys. And we put on our team jerseys and we play the game. But that budget sets some restrictions on the appropriators and what they can do. And it also, through the reconciliation process, sets you up to do things like taxes. Now, in that process, what you've done is then take this general form of each side, whether it's Democrats in the majority or Republicans in the majority, as this is what we believe we would like to do. This is our fondest ambition for how we'd like the government to work. And then you have to bring this reality into it in reconciliation, the reality of a tax changes or spending changes or the debt limit. And on top of that, you have the reality of the appropriations process, which is really down on the, I mean, that's real walking in the dirt reality. Now, my allowance when I was a kid was, I was told I would get 50 cents if I did these things. If I didn't do the things, I didn't get the 50 cents. So my authorization was that I would get 50 cents a week. I didn't do the right stuff. I didn't get 50 cents a week. My appropriation was whatever if they decided I'd done a quarter's worth of work, I did a quarter's worth. The appropriations process is real money, as you all know. But that process is very real, and it gets down to the very nitty-gritty. And I think part of what has happened here is as the process of the Budget Impoundment Control Act, which was imagined to be one thing, a process so we can spend more and more and more money each year, but had within it the seeds of its own destruction in many ways. And nobody, I'm not sure anybody could have imagined this when they created it back in 1973 and 74. But What you found is that this process has brought us to a point where the really hard gut work, that where the appropriation, where the budget has an impact, that is setting the totals of the appropriations. Then you try and implement those totals of appropriations, and it becomes very, very hard to do. And the appropriations process is where Congress has given up more and more and more of its power. We no longer have three equal branches of government. We've got an executive branch, which over the years, you can look at Republican and Democrat presidents, has tried to pull more and more power control to itself. It's not only the White House, it's the bureaucracy that surrounds them. You've got a judicial branch in which I'm sure there are many members of the Federalist Society would argue has a number of rogue judges in it who are making law where they have no right to make law. That's not their job. That's not what the Constitution says they can do, but they do. And you have a Congress which, by virtue of not doing appropriations bills or writing skeletal legislation that we then send downtown and have a whole bunch of people down there, hired many more people than work up here, to write all the details of those laws. And we've been doing this, frankly, for more and more and more for 100 years. I would argue it starts with Woodrow Wilson. Francis may correct me in that, but I would say, I would argue this starts with Woodrow Wilson, this ceding of power to the executive branch. And during the period of FDR, it grew greatly. And during the period of the Great Society and Lyndon Johnson, it grew even more. But Congress has participated in giving up its own power. You look at Article I, the most important power of Congress. The reason Congress can be equal to the other two branches is because they have the power of the purse. If I do a continuing resolution, if I do an omnibus resolution that really copies a lot from last year, maybe makes a few changes on the side, year after year after year, what have I lost? I've lost the power of the purse to go in and specifically say to this agency or that department or the administration in this way or that way, this is what we want you to do. And I'm old enough to remember when we used to have real fights about those things. I'm old enough to remember when one of the appropriations subcommittees didn't like a person who had been nominated by Ronald Reagan for a job in the Ag Department, and they defunded it. They defunded the job because they didn't like the guy. Imagine that happening today. I don't think you can and see it go through the process. It went through the process. They defunded the job. Once the administration backed down and didn't put the guy in the job, they refunded it, and they got the guy in the job, the new person in the job. That's the type of power the power of the purse is. And we have none of that now, and it's because Congress has given it away. Congress has also given away their ability to control what is known right now in Trump talk as the swamp. One of the things that happened in the election is a lot of people were surprised on late Tuesday night and early Wednesday morning that Donald Trump was going to be elected president of the United States. And I was working for Paul Ryan at the time, and the speaker had a press conference Wednesday morning, and he said, I'm like a lot of people. I did not understand and hear what was going on in this country. And Donald Trump spoke to people of this country in a way that a lot of us didn't understand. And I've been trying to figure it out. I suspect some of you have been trying to figure it out. And I think there's probably a whole bunch of people who, what Francis does, have been trying to figure it out. But I think part of it is that people, this idea of draining the swamp and, you know, what exactly does it mean? Here's what I think it means. And we can all decide what we think it means, because it doesn't cost you anything to hear what I think it means, and doesn't cost me anything to hear what you think it means. But I think people are looking at this, and a lot of them just feel the government is too big for them. They don't understand it. Whether it's the IRS you think is too big, whether you think the EPA doesn't go far enough in its regulations or goes too far in its regulations, whether you think you're running into this, that, or the other problem, because at your work you see it happening, in your family you see it happening. Whatever it may be, the bureaucracy has gotten to be something that people really fear and feel has nobody controls it. It is in and of itself a power, a force. Let me use that instead of pejoratives. A power and a force that nobody can really control. And in fact, if you look at appropriations subcommittee hearings, and the appropriations cardinals will tell you this, the people who come up from the departments and from the agencies and the administration no longer are worried that they're going to have this appropriations committee sort of rearrange their budget or cut it or if they can make a good enough argument, increase it, because, frankly, they don't see the appropriations bills ever getting done. And so that tension that is supposed to be there, that was created by the founders between the executive branch and the legislative branch of government, mostly controlled by the power of the purse, has been given up. And Congress is going to have to figure out, I think the budget process and the appropriations process and sort of the reality and the hard, dirty work of the appropriations or writing tax bills or the other things that come out of the budget have made it more difficult to do the job we need to do in appropriations. And in some ways, this budget process is going to have to be reconciled, I think, over time with sort of the what it has created in and of itself, and how do we get back to doing that? We can all have suggestions. I have some suggestions. You have some suggestions. Let me just say one, and then I'll stop, and we'll take questions. I think a lot of this process is harmed and doesn't work because we don't vote. One of the things about democracy is if you don't practice it, it doesn't work very well. And whether that democracy is a subcommittee hearing, a subcommittee markup, and a full committee hearing, and a full committee markup, and being on the floor of the House and the Senate, both sides, both bodies, both parties, you simply have to vote. And yes, it is true that with these things in our pockets and other advances in communications, we have never known so much that's wrong in this world. It's just flat-out wrong information. Because I can get more wrong information off of this thing in 10 minutes than I could have gotten in a lifetime before these things were created. Some of it's right, some of it's not. But yes, you can communicate that way, and yes, you can start things happening and make people talk about things. But the real answer is, how do we solve problems? And you solve problems by voting, because there is a tension. There's in a democratic process between the people and the ideas and the parties. And if you never do this, it never gets to the point where it rubs off and you're able to do things and find compromises. If you just don't let this happen, they're doing this, everybody's right. As long as I don't get a vote, I know I win. I know I'm going to win this vote until I take it and I get 20 votes. Everybody's always going to win. They wouldn't, everybody, whatever I'm doing has to be smart. No, and it may not be. But as long as you're doing this and never get these two together, to rub that off and start getting to the point where you can find a way for it to work and not so much friction be there. And that's voting. And it's voting in the House, and it's voting in committees, and it's voting in the Senate. And I know it can be very unhappy, and all these phones and things and radio talk shows and TV news programs that run 24/7 and have to have something to say every minute of the 24/7 make it more difficult in some ways. But the answer is still democracy, and it is still voting. And I'm naive enough to believe if we get back to doing that, the nature of this institution when I first joined it was that it was, I'll guarantee you, in 1976 and 77, Republican and Democrat members of the House of Representatives knew their colleagues, both within their conferences and in the other conference, much better than they do today. Much better on a personal basis. Part of that was that they lived here in town. Part of it was that they were thrown together and worked 4 or 5 days a week. Part of it was just the human side of that institution, and they voted. They voted on things. Now, you know, Republicans complained when they were in the minority in that period of time, which they were, part of that long minority, that they didn't get to do what they wanted to do. And none of, fine, but they were actually voting. They were actually working in committee. They were doing things. The process worked. I think the process works pretty well, because I think a process was set up frankly, a providential way by people who are far smarter than us. And I'll rely on Madison and Jay and Hamilton for what they set up and how they told us to work this until I hear somebody I think smarter than them. So far, I haven't heard it. Let me stop there and we'll take questions.
Okay. Great. Thank you both very much. Professor Lee, offer you an opportunity if you'd like to respond to any comments that David made.
I would just I'd like to ask Dave a question about what he thinks the prospects for Congress reasserting its powers are in the current environment. Before the 2016 elections, when I expected that there would be a continuation of divided government, I was pretty optimistic that that Congress would be able to, make more use of the power of the purse and to make more use of its constitutional powers. But unified government often cuts against Congress asserting itself as Congress looks to the White House to take the lead. And so I was wondering what you think the prospects are for an Article I initiative or Congress reasserting itself more generally in the system.
I think internally Congress has to solve its own problems before it can reassert them vis-a-vis the White House. And I think both parties within the Congress have very factionalized. Is that a word? And they have to figure out how to move forward. And I was, once again, having been here a long time, I got to see a lot of what the Reagan administration did. And frankly, Ronald Reagan compromised virtually every day of his presidency. Now, he used to be famous for saying, I'll take 70% of the loaf now and come back and get the 30% later. Because his view was, it was his job to improve the country. And he thought that a lot of things in the country were wrong. And he's had policies and worked with Congress to establish policies. Whether you like them, didn't like them, that's not really the issue here. The issue here is, how do you move forward? And Ronald Reagan's view was, I have to move forward by having the government do things differently and in a way that will provide, in his case, for growth, for stronger defense, whatever. Those were the issues. But he was willing to compromise. I'd love to give you a good example of that. He ran in 1980. One of the issues that was very important to Ronald Reagan was what called a Kemp-Roth tax cuts. Now, Kemp-Roth tax cuts were a 30% across-the-board tax rate reduction immediately. Ronald Reagan hadn't been in office 30 days before they had already started to work and had compromised on that. And in the end, that bill was passed in July and then finally passed, the conference report passed in either late July or August, I'd have to look at the date, which cut taxes, in Kemp-Roth style, 25% across the board over 2.5 years. Now, imagine if you campaigned in this Congress right today on 30% across the board now, and what you got was 25% over 2.5 years. I think the place would go up in flames. But Ronald Reagan believed it would work. He got it. He found ways of and he needed, in that House of Representatives, we had 192 Republicans. And if you wanted to pass anything, every day of the week, we had to get 26 Democrats, or we didn't pass anything. Now, for the first two years of Ronald Reagan's presidency, every major issue that came out of the Budget Committee and the Ways and Means Committee, tax bills, budgets, and what were, the reconciliation bill we did at that time, what the committee reported out was defeated on the floor and substituted for by a coalition product that was mostly Republicans and be someplace between 26 and 40 or 45 Democrats. And every time, so the Ways and Means Committee didn't pass one bill it had reported, and the Budget Committee didn't pass one bill it had reported in those 2 years. And because Ronald Reagan could figure out a way to work and compromise. And he didn't get everything he wanted, but he got enough, he thought, to change the direction of the country. You can judge for yourself, like it. I'm not talking about liking or disliking. I'm simply talking about how the process worked. And that's a process which we don't see much anymore. And you don't see it on the Democratic side, and you don't see it on the Republican side. But we've got to get back to that. So I think to solve that problem, I guess I'm dodging the answer a little bit, but the parties in Congress, I mean, if the Democrats take over everything in 2020, I'm not sure they aren't going to have some of the same problems we see the Republicans having right now. In fact, I would predict we are going to see some of those same problems. But that's Congress has to get its own house in order, I think, before they can answer that question.
So is that a message for the voters, that we need to send different sorts of leaders to Congress who adhere to maybe the prior ways in which legislating was done?
Once again, I leave it to the voters to make those decisions. But internally here, you have to you solve problems by finding, by moving forward and contesting ideas. Ideas don't get contested without votes. You don't have to sharpen your ideas or figure out a way to say, okay, I can't, I've got 19 of the, you know, in the committee, I need 19 votes to pass this. And I got 17. If I make this little change, do I get to 19 or 20? And do I actually get something done? If you don't have votes, you don't ever get to that point of the process. We've got to go back to this. And it's in some ways, it's getting to be shockingly radical to say, gee, we ought to vote more. But we ought to vote more.
Questions from the audience? Right here, sir. Please, go ahead.
My question would be to both of you, really. There is something I believe is referred to as the Gingrich reforms. When he became the Speaker of the House, there was a number of things that changed. No earmarks, for instance, were eliminated. No one could be chairman of more than one subcommittee at a time. Mm-hmm. And I believe there's a 6-year limit as to how long someone could be chair of a committee. These things were looked at as real reforms, particularly the earmark, but the earmarks gave the speaker, it gave the committee chair power over members, because you wouldn't get the road in your district if you didn't go along with it, with what was going on. But if we did away with these things, do you think that these kind of reforms that came about when Gingrich became speaker had a real impact on the inability of Congress to get anything done today?
That's an interesting way of framing that question, the impact of the Gingrich reforms. That, in general, the understanding is that it helped to centralize power in Congress. That by term limiting committee chairs were no longer able to, to build up baronies, you know, influence over agencies because they're going to be there for.
Chair for John Dingell.
Yeah, right. then the leadership had a bigger role in choosing who would be committee chairs, and seniority was not respected in terms of the choice of committee chairs, so they should be handpicked to work with the leadership. It ought to have made the parties be able to work more cohesively together. That was the intent, and I would argue that it probably did have that effect. The question now is whether leadership is able to get enough buy-in from members. You know, the centralization of power, the downside of that is if members don't trust the leadership, then a centralized process is one that they feel left out of. And that mistrust is corrosive to party unity. And so one benefit of the old, more decentralized way is that it produced more buy-in on the part of members. But at the cost of, Gingrich could look at the struggles that the Democrats, for their long years in the majority, had trying to act in any kind of coherent way when committee chairs were there because of their seniority and could not be replaced and felt free to do whatever they wanted regardless of what the general, rank-and-file members of the Democratic Party wanted to do or what the leadership wanted to do. So they addressed that old problem. Maybe we have new problems now.
I agree with that. It's intriguing that Speaker Gingrich is a transitional character because I remember after the 94 elections, I was working on the Senate side at that time for Senator Lott. and several press people came up to him and said, "Are you sorry you left the House?" And he said, "Why?" He said, "Well, you would have been Speaker." And he said, "No." He said, "I would never have done what Newt did that made him Speaker." And that's, got to unpack these a little. Some of the things you're talking about were done as actually Republican conference rules. Some of them were done as rules of the House and other ways. But they, I'm not sure those things are necessary to get back. I'm not sure you have to have earmarks again to get back. I think there are problems which are deeper than that, if you will. And in fact, earmarks, I can argue them round and I can argue them square. And the reason I say that is because it never made much sense to me why somebody downtown in the bureaucracy could tell a congressman more where money should be spent in his district or tell the state where money should be spent better than the state could figure it out. And in some ways, that's what earmarks were. This is where I need the bridge. No, that's, a congressman is going to have a much better idea of that than, I don't care who you are in the transportation department. They're just going to have a better idea of that. And that's fair. Having said that, they were also used to buy votes. And I mean, in the Republicans suffered from this greatly, and I think a big part of the internal problem among Republicans, and in 2006, one of the reasons they lost control of the House is because people saw this, even if they didn't understand exactly what was going on. It was way, way out of hand. I mean, you were just, that's not the purpose. If earmarks have a purpose, it is to have more intimate knowledge of where the money should go by the people who know it best because they're in their districts, not because you need to buy somebody's vote. You get to that point, and so, as I said, I can argue them round, argue them square, but once again, it comes back to, are you, as a party, as a group, going to believe that you have to make changes, and sometimes they're going to be incremental, not wholesale. And that's what neither party has reconciled itself to yet. I mean, you watch the introduction of Senator Sanders' single-payer bill. Everybody who wants to run for president got on it real fast, and then it sort of dropped off. I suspect the drop-off is in quite a different place from those people, as long as all that's being talked about is it's not, you know, it's going to get a vote and lose, which it would, right? At this point, doesn't mean very much. If it all of a sudden becomes something that has to be done in January of 2021, that's going to be... some of these internal things you tend to see when you have responsibility for governing, if you're in the majority of the House, majority of the Senate, and the White House, they all have to come to the fore. So, but once again, realistically, Congress as an institution has to regain its power, and they have to pull that power back on the power of the purse. They have to make the appropriations system work, and they have to be able to pass appropriations bills, not as a big lump, but one by one by one. And they have to start pulling back on the bureaucracy. I mean, we have ceded so much power to the bureaucracy, and then we complain about the regs they write. As far as I'm concerned, we have no reason to complain. We're the ones who didn't put enough detail in the legislation so that they couldn't screw it up or get them wrong, or we can't blame them for it. There's different ways you can do that. There's people who have proposed different ideas for going about that. But Congress has to pull that power back, and they have to pull back the power of the purse. And once they do that, you're going to feel like you're really doing a job around here. If you're in committee, subcommittee every day and committee every day, and you're voting and you're moving things and things are happening, you're going to feel like this job makes a difference. And I think there's a feeling that right now, we don't make enough of a difference. And I think I would argue those things have to be done before you would do the others. But have those had an impact? I think they have, but I think there's other things that have had a greater impact.
Very good. I think there was a question back here. So, same question. Other questions?
There was no discussion about how the role of congressional calendar passing appropriations and budget process. I mean, essentially, there's 5 months where Congress is taking no action on the budget at all. October, November, December, January, August. If some changes were made to the congressional calendar, do you think that that might help get a budget done on time? Just throwing out an, I don't know the answer. I don't have an idea. I'm just throwing it out for discussion.
I'm not supposed to say this. I would argue trying to think how to say this so I don't sound like I'm petty.
Some would argue
we need longer weeks. Anecdotally, I will tell you that in 1999 and the year 2000, when we had a Republican Senate and a Republican House and a Democratic president, the schedules were such that we could not figure out when or how to hold a conference meeting. We couldn't do it. Between the House and when they came in and the Senate when they came in, and if the House wasn't going to be here, the Senate wouldn't be here, and if the Senate wasn't going to be the House, we literally could not hold a conference meeting in that 45 minutes on Wednesday afternoon that you had where both everybody was here. I'm not kidding you. Figuring out how to hold a conference committee was virtually impossible at the time. These institutions can't work that way. And so I would argue, you know, people are saying, cancel the August recess. Fine, okay. I'm sort of agnostic on it. Go ahead, cancel it if you want. Work 5 days a week. Take a week off every month, I don't care. But work 5 days a week. And you'll get more done because actually the interaction that 5 days a week gives you, I think, maybe I'm just wrong in that, but I've been remarkably unsuccessful arguing that to senators and House members both.
On that point, I'd say that the shortening congressional weeks, it's hard to reverse that because constituents come to expect their members to be there, and once this pattern is set, and you know jet travel enables you to do it. I mean, the reason why members of Congress used to stay here for longer stretches is because it wasn't even feasible, except for those on the Northeast Corridor, to go home every weekend. And so, you know, as members have shown that they can do it, even in the even West Coast, that they can go home every weekend, then constituents come to expect it. And then second, that everything about the Congress is affected by this intensely competitive environment for majority control. And, you know, not a handful of seats swings and majority control switches. And so it's very important for parties to protect their vulnerable members, which means give them time to mend fences back at home. And so that puts a lot of constraints on the congressional calendar.
Well, Professor Lee, I think you said at the beginning that there really was no defense of omnibus spending bills on the merits. But given, as he mentioned, the constraints on the calendar, I mean, isn't that really the reason for them and where we're at now? And are there ways that we can make it better or really move back to a more regular process?
I mean, I see omnibus legislating as a pragmatic adjustment to today's realities. In fact, I don't really think you could just go right back to regular order. Like, I don't think we can just, you know, create a calendar and then expect members to live up to it. I think Dave is right that it has to come from within the Congress, and the Congress has to cohere. They have to decide what their priorities are. But they can't do that in the absence of the American people also deciding what party's going to be in the majority. You know, this constant competition politicizes congressional processes more than they were in an environment where members were not as constantly preoccupied by the next set of elections. But that traces back to the electoral circumstances of the country, and until the American people seem to have made a decision, then Congress has to muddle through and, you know, try to resolve conflicts sufficiently to keep government in operation and to make incremental progress when possible, but you know, hard to settle anything in an environment like this.
And Dave, are there legislative solutions that you could put forward that would roll back some of the unintended consequences of the Budget Act from 74 that you talked about earlier?
A friend of mine has suggested that what you do is make one change in the Budget Act. And that is, you say that as of, pick a date, June 30th would be a nice date, maybe do a little earlier than that. If the Congress has not passed a budget, that the president's budget becomes the budget. That's it. I mean, just automatic. Nothing you can do about it. Can't stop it. It's there. So that's what you got, and that's what you got to work with. You know, like the guillotine focuses the mind, yeah. That might do it.
Might force some full work weeks, too, right?
Maybe more than one.
Yeah. Other questions from the audience? Yes, sir, please.
I want to follow up on what David Hope just said.
Sure.
Gerald Ford, he didn't put this in the lunch, but after he was president, he favored a constitutional amendment that said Congress couldn't do anything at the beginning of a session until it passed appropriations bills. It couldn't do anything else. And so it would hold them, you know.
Yeah.
I like your idea about, you know, the president's budget becomes the budget, you know, becomes the appropriations if they don't act within a certain number of days or something. But Gerald Ford, who, of course, had the experience of being up there in the House for so long, he had the idea that, you know, they couldn't do any, only if the president declared an emergency and then it would take a two-thirds vote of each House. But otherwise, they couldn't do anything else.
There have been arguments. Arguments in recent years that the agenda for Congress ought to be, let's do the budget and appropriations bills, and we can do nothing else until we get those done. And we start in January whenever we come back in every year to do this and do it that way. Has some advantage. I also think, there's ways one can imagine making the budget reflect more of the reality that it runs into, as opposed to being a document of high-minded thoughts, purposes, and our goals in life and what will make us happy next Tuesday, having it more clearly reflect exactly what you want to do on taxes and exactly what you want to do on spending by having debates and voting those two things. Most of us, as we look at our lives, our personal lives, I can sit down and say, gee, I'm going to spend $750,000 this year. There's just one problem with that. I don't make $750,000. I mean, $75,000. I mean, we start not with what we want to spend for the year. We start in our own personal lives with what we make. And we sit down, my wife and I sit down and say, what's our budget? We say, well, what do we make? We don't say, golly, I'd really like to do this. Let's go buy an airplane. Okay, I can't fly one, first of all. But secondly, I haven't got the money. And you start with where the money comes from. Well, and this is not to say you aren't ever going to deficit spend, but why don't you start with saying, okay, how much do we want to take from the private sector every year in taxes? Obviously, that's my version of how I view taxes. But apart from that, if you start by saying, well, what are we going to take from the American people this year? How much are we going to make? And your tax policies can tell you, not exactly, but broadly where that is. And then you maybe have a fight about how much you're going to bring in. And once you've had that fight and you've decided what it is, then you decide how you're going to spend it. Or if you're going to spend more than that. And if you're going to spend more than that, then you got some decisions to make. And one of them is a debt limit increase on top of all the other decisions you make. But instead of I think it goes back some ways to sort of this cash register idea of the Budget Impoundment and Reform Act, which was, we'll figure out, we're just going to spend. This is going to help us spend more and more money each year. Okay. Does that have anything to do, you know, with, can we, there are then arguments between deficit spending and how you control of that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which you have. But you ought to have them in a rational way, and the budget didn't really set us up to do that. I think the budget set us up to do a lot of things that Francis was saying, which is, this is happy time. Yeah. All the balloons are full with, and they've just had that, you know, helium put in them, and they're all way up there high. But down here where, you know, 6 months from now where the balloon's gone and you're trying to do an appropriations bill or a tax bill, it's a very different world.
I'll give you both an opportunity for any concluding remarks, but one last call for questions, if there's questions from the audience. Okay. Professor Lee, would you like to?
I don't have a concluding statement. One question that I have, it's been a long time since I've heard anybody working on Capitol Hill have anything good to say about the budget process. And I sort of wonder whether there's any impetus building for reform of that. I haven't heard any proposals that seem to garner substantial support, but I am struck by the fact that no one defends the budget process now. So, food for thought.
Yeah. Well, there's congressmen who have retired because they didn't think we were ever going to get serious about reforming the budget process. I mean, I literally know of cases of congressmen who have retired because that was what they thought was really important, and it was clear to them, it became clear to them that was never going to happen. I think we have to... We have to reconcile sort of the pieces of this. But I will end with sort of a question, which I don't know the answer to, because as you look at the charts you put up, we see periods that are like this period. Now, this is, as you pointed out, the longest of these we've had. Sort of when does that change? Because I'm convinced at some point it will, because it has all the other times. One party or the other has sort of figured out a way that the people sort of said, okay, that's what I like. That's what I want to do. And it's the people, I mean, probably the ones we call independents today. Because if one of the parties or the other party sort of figures out what appeals to independents, I think we're going to establish an ability to do things with enough authority to do them over time. And whether, I don't know whether it's a Republican or a Democrat one, I can't tell you that. I don't know, but I think... And then sort of we're in the middle of this, and it's hard to analyze when you're in the middle of one of these interregnums mm-hmm. or periods, which, you know, when you're going to come out of it. But somebody's going to figure that out, I think. I just don't know when, which side, and who.
Well, the other factor is that the Federal Society's Article I initiative comes at the very end of those charts. So, mm-hmm. you know, we'll see how it goes going forward.
Solve all the problems. It could be the solution.
So thank you all very much for coming today. We want to thank our wonderful speakers. They were, as advertised, great, and really think they deserve a round of applause. So, if you'd like more information about the Article I initiative, please go to our website, fedsoc.org/articlei. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.